Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
Any forward progress in technology involves some rational assumption of risk. And the way Google is thinking about that is, okay, how do we proceed both boldly and responsibly? Because the promise of these technologies is just so overwhelming.
Google's chief privacy officer, Keith Enright, talking about their approach to AI and privacy.
Take on tomorrow from PwC's Strategy and Business. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. On this edition, we asked, should there be a global wealth tax? And we've a fascinating interview with an economic advisor to Donald Trump, lifting the lid on some of the economic plans we might see if Trump returns to the American presidency.
We're going to see a massive increase in American energy output under Trump. We're going to use our oil, our gas, our coal, our nuclear power, and we think we can bring the price of gasoline at the pump down to less than $2 a gallon.
More from that interview coming up, but let's start the program in Kenya, where there have been more protests against an unpopular finance bill, which includes several tax rises. It's a country facing an economic crisis. It's heavily in debt, and inflation has been high. That's led to growing anger, and now thousands of people have taken to the streets across the country on Monday, including in the capital, Nairobi. At least five people have reported to have been shot dead. Many more have been injured in those protests. In a televised address, the country's president, Mr. Ruto, said the demonstrations had been hijacked by dangerous criminals.
It is very painful for Kenya that a conversation this crucial was hijacked by dangerous people who have caused us the kind of loss we have incurred as a nation today. It is possible that the criminals who rained terror on innocent people and attempted to challenge our law enforcement deployments are still determined to continue with their dangerous behavior. I assure the nation of the government's determination to fulfill its constitutional duty of protecting the people of Kenya against all forms of harm.
We wanted to hear from people from the business community of Kenya who have been out on the streets protesting. So, firstly, let's hear from Wanjiru Mutai, Global Communications Manager at Ashoka, a social enterprise based in Nairobi.
It has gotten to a point where everybody's feeling aggrieved, whether or not you take up. One thing that we've seen is the politicians are displaying a vast amount of wealth with really no source of income. Or even if they have a source of income, whatever they are earning does not translate into the kind of wealth that they are showing. And now what we are calling for is accountability on the government's part. We need all these corruption to stop. We are really tired of the spending problems that the government has. Like recently, the president has been taking numerous trips abroad, but the health services here are suffering. Our teachers are calling for pay. The schools are not funded, but politicians have the money to fly out, not just themselves, but also their families. We have a problem, and this really needs to be addressed. If the political class would want to see change, or they want to see change even in the electorate, we need them to also listen to our pleas and our cries and our demands, because this is our country, all of us, and we are all vested in the success. We want to see our country succeeding, and the only way that can happen is when we end corruption.
You can hear some of the anger in Wanjiru's voice there. Well, I also spoke to Felix Achuga. He's a businessman. He's the CEO of HecoPay. They're our fintech company. And I asked him whether the anger was just about the potential tax rises or whether it was more than that.
It's beyond taxes. We actually don't have a problem with paying taxes. If you ask a normal Kenyan, they'll tell you what we are interested in is that, is this money being used for the right reasons? We're just tired of more money is always being asked of us. We have so many people suffering across the country. They're not able to meet their daily needs, and you're expected to take more out of them. But what makes this worse is rampant taxes. It's just too much. Enough is enough.
When you say rampant taxes, which of the recent tax proposals, when you're out on the streets, are the ones that are causing the most anger? Is it the ones to do with the increase in fuel? Or is it the bread tax? Or is it the sanitary pad tax? Which one is it?
The reality is, whether it's sanitary pads, whether it's diapers, whether it's fuel, whether it's bread, those are like what you call them gaslighters. There's so much evil within the new finance bill. There is an aspect of where I have to be taxed for my freehold property. Something that was passed to me over generations, I have to pay tax to it. This is something that has never happened before.
Do you understand that the government is facing a serious financial crisis at the moment? It needs to raise money so that it can pay its expenditures. It can pay people who work for it. It can try and invest in areas to help the country grow. So do you understand the need?
Yes, I understand the need. I can give you 1 million reasons why the government needs to raise taxes. We can't spend more than 40% of taxes on wages. This is wrong. If you want to see a company going down, let 30% of the all expenses of the revenue going into wages. This is wrong. We have 47% of revenue that is collected in Kenya going into wages. If you reduce the wage bill by 10%, it is enough. 2 years by the new president, no development, nothing to see for it. Nothing whatsoever.
Can I ask you about your own business? What is that like at the moment? How hard is it to run a business in Kenya in the current economic conditions?
It's crazy. We are barely trying to get into the market. You really need a lot of resources to stay in the market, let alone thrive. We get threats daily that, hey, you have an innovative model, but we're going to come in. We are in what you're calling this French Revolution back in the 17th and 18th century. Where if they're not careful, today they burn the parliament, I don't know what they're going to do tomorrow.
The emotions are clearly running very high in Kenya. You know that you need investment. That investment has to come from the outside. When people see the scenes they see in Kenya, even though they may understand the anger, that is not going to help investment coming into the country, is it?
We need to understand one thing. The cost of capital in Kenya is at 25%.
Is that the situation you're facing?
That's the start of it. That's the cost of capital. We've not talked about crazy taxes that are coming about. Or I'm told, okay, you need to introduce this social fund. We are increasing another fund we're introducing. It's just so hard because we're living in an economy that can't work for you. It's simple as that. You finish up high school and then you get to university and then you have all this. You have to find out your funding education. You don't have money. So what do? You borrow from the government. And then you get into employment, which is 1 out of 100 chance. I'm sure the reason why the European economy has grown so fast, even China, it's because let's reduce the taxes, let's reduce the cost of capital, and then let's pour more capital into the businesses ecosystem so that it can run. Our members of parliaments care about what goes into their pockets.
Felix there, another annoyed business owner. We wanted to give you a sense of the wider economic problems that are facing Kenya, and those reflect problems facing other emerging economies. How big is its debt? That's a question I put to Professor John Mbuku, a professor of economics at Weber State University in Utah, who's an expert on the Kenyan economy.
The country has a very significant amount of debt, depending on who you ask, about $82 billion, $45.5 billion of which is external debt. Out of that external debt, about $4.4 billion is with the IMF. And the IMF is putting conditionalities on Kenya that are making it very difficult for the government to operate. When you have that kind of debt as a country, you have to face debt service. And that means that you have to generate enough revenues locally to be able to service the debt and then still perform as a government. And for a developing country like Kenya, where you face a significant level of poverty, you have to provide services like education, power, food assistance to the poor. And given the food inflation that Kenya has been suffering from as a result of the problems with the war in Ukraine, the government has a lot of issues to deal with.
Servicing that debt as well is becoming more expensive, not just for Kenya, but for many emerging economies, because interest rates are much higher now than they were, let's say, a decade ago.
Yes, you're right. They're not going down. They're continuing to go up. And it's becoming more and more difficult for poor countries like Kenya.
Does the government have any other option that they can do? They are under pressure from global financial bodies like the International Monetary Fund, who give them money to keep going, but only if they do certain things.
The traditional solution for a situation like this would be to improve the functioning of the local economy so that you can generate more resources locally, especially with respect to exports. And Kenya has been a very good exporter. But the fact that the government is handling the protests in a very poor manner, in a very violent manner, means that they're actually interfering with the very process that would have allowed them to generate more resources locally. One thing that the government can do is to withdraw this violent approach to protest in order to allow the economy to continue to operate.
Can I ask you about organizations like the International Monetary Fund? Many of the protesters are angry at organizations like that. Are they part of the problem in the conditions that they put on economies like Kenya to get money?
It is not appropriate for us to blame the International Monetary Fund completely, but we have to keep in mind that the government of Kenya also has a part to play in what is happening domestically. The International Monetary Fund did not force Kenya to accept the terms of the borrowing. And so the IMF do not have the power to simply wipe out the debt that Kenya owes to them. So I think that if Kenya is willing to go back to the International Monetary Fund and try to renegotiate the terms of the debt, they may be able to gain some relief. Violence is not going to solve the problem. It's only going to make things worse in terms of destroying the economy and making it much more difficult for the government to derive the resources that they need to service the debt and to provide social services for the people.
Professor John Mbuku there, Professor of Economics at Weber State University. And some of those protesters have had signs demonstrating the anger they have against organizations like the International Monetary Fund. With me throughout the program is Ayoko Yoshioka, Senior Portfolio Manager, Wealth Enhancement Group. And she joins us from Los Angeles. Welcome back to the program. What's happening in Kenya, that debt, it's a problem for many countries, isn't it? And it's an issue we talk a lot about. Interest rates have gone up so much over the last few years. That's difficult for businesses, also difficult for governments, isn't it?
Absolutely, Rahul. We've continued to talk about just the overall sovereign debt issues that many countries have continued to face as interest rates have climbed higher. It's less of a consumer issue that we saw probably 10 years ago in which consumers were over indebted. Now it seems like many governments are having some of these debt and balance sheet issues.
And just simply, it means that they have to pay more to service that debt, don't they? And it's a lot more.
Absolutely. You know, part of the reason why was because they had to combat inflation, and to combat inflation, you had to raise the cost of capital, but that in turn raises the cost of servicing the debt. So it's a difficult situation for many governments and economies.
It certainly is, and one that we will continue to talk about.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI. Aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Any forward progress in technology involves some rational assumption of risk. And the way Google is thinking about that is, okay, how do we proceed both boldly and responsibly? Because the promise of these technologies is just so overwhelming.
Google's chief privacy officer, Keith Enright, talking about their approach to AI and privacy.
Take On Tomorrow from PwC Strategy and Business. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Later this week, we'll have the first presidential debate in the United States. We'll be previewing it on Business Matters later this week. President Biden and former President Trump will use it to outline their plans to grow the world's largest economy. We wanted to give you a sense of what Donald Trump's economic vision is. So I've been speaking to Stephen Moore, a senior visiting fellow in economics at the Heritage Foundation and an informal advisor to Donald Trump. He's also the author of Trumponomics, Inside the American's First Plan to Revive Our Economy.
What Donald Trump wants to do is reignite the American economy in a way that we haven't seen in the last few years. Now, we've had very high inflation. We've had very high interest rates. We've had middle income families struggling. And so I think what Trump wants to do more than anything else is really lift the boats of the people in the middle. They're the people who've suffered the most under Biden's policies. They're the ones who've really gotten crushed under the inflation. And so the first order of business will be to try to help middle-class Americans by bringing down inflation, by reducing their taxes, by providing more high-paying jobs, and bringing businesses back to the United States.
Inflation is coming down now, isn't it? The rate of inflation is coming down. President Biden had a series of factors to deal with, which meant it wasn't just the U.S., just about every major economy suffered from inflation.
True, but let's be very clear about it. What caused the massive inflation, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind about this, I think most Americans agree, is that Joe Biden came into the office and spent $4 trillion that we didn't have on a massive spending spree that did great damage to the American economy and has done so much damage to the nation's finances that it will be decades and decades before we can undo the damage that Biden has done to our country's finances. So the inflation didn't happen by accident. It happened as a direct result of the massive spending spree that America couldn't afford.
Well, if you look at that spending spree, many countries had to do that because these were extraordinary circumstances, COVID, people not going to work for long periods of time. People took measures that we haven't seen before. Donald Trump would have had to do the same, wouldn't he?
Well, actually, the problem with that narrative is that when Trump left office a year into COVID, the inflation rate was 1.5%. So in 18 months, somehow Joe Biden took our inflation rate from 1.5% to 9.1%, the highest it had been in 30 years. We want to restore fiscal integrity, and we want to restore a situation where prices are stable. And, you know, Donald Trump has a plan to do that. He wants to do it through the supply side of the economy, increase the production of goods and services. One really easy area where we can reduce prices that I think will happen almost immediately is we're going to see a massive increase in American energy output under Trump. We're going to use our oil, our gas, our coal, our nuclear power. And we think we can bring the price of gasoline at the pump down to less than $2 a gallon.
Fascinating to hear from Stephen Moore. The Ayoko, the presidential debate will be interesting when that takes place later this week. Is it as simple as two different policies on issues like taxation? Donald Trump looking more at tax cuts, maybe President Biden looking less at them. Could that be one of the key economic differences between them?
For sure. I think, you know, their approaches to even things like tariffs are very different. Trump, I think, wants to have a more broad tariff policy versus Biden being more targeted. And you could argue that, you know, even if their tax impacts could be different on inflation, perhaps it's evened out by their tariff policies.
Interestingly, though, they're both quite similar on dealing with China. They both have quite strong economic policies when it comes to their great trading rival.
Absolutely. A lot of tariffs have gone on it to specifically target China, whether it be from Biden or from Trump.
Yes, let's see how that debate shapes out. Now, here's a question. In a world of great inequality, should billionaires pay a minimum amount of tax? It's estimated that there are more than 3,000 of them, so even just a guaranteed 2% level of tax could raise hundreds of billions of dollars. Well, the G20 group of countries representing some of the most economically powerful in the world has just launched a report which proposes just that. I spoke to the man behind that report, Gabriel Zucman. He's a professor at the Paris School of Economics, and I asked him how a global tax scheme would work.
The idea is for countries to agree on a standard, a norm, that super high net worth individuals should pay a minimum amount of tax each and every year, which is not the case today. Billionaires today pay very little, most of them, in taxes. And once we have agreed on that norm, it can be implemented flexibly by countries through different instruments. It could be with a wealth tax. It could be with what is known as a presumptive income tax. It could be with a tax on a broad notion of income, including unrealized capital gains, like Joe Biden proposes to do in the US. But that's the basic idea. Let's agree on the principle, the mere principle, that billionaires should pay each and every year at least 2% of their wealth in tax.
When we're talking about who would pay this tax, is that what it would be, a billionaire in dollars? What is the criteria for people to fall under whatever form of taxation system comes into effect?
In the baseline proposal, it is indeed dollar billionaires who would be affected by the tax. The report also considers extending this minimum tax to a broader segment of the population, people with more than $100 million in wealth. Again, like in the Biden billionaire minimum tax that Joe Biden has in his budget that actually starts at $100 million in wealth. But the idea is to have this squarely focused, in any case, on the super rich. Why? Because it is where we have a clear, unacceptable problem today, which is that these individuals, those who have the highest ability to pay taxes, who have benefited the most from globalization, are also those who have the lowest effective tax rates today. A 2% minimum tax on billionaires would raise between $200 billion and $250 billion in tax revenue globally.
There are those who are against this idea, who say that that 2% tax will take away money that is flowing around anyway and is being invested in companies at the moment and helping to grow economies. That money would suddenly disappear. Actually, where it's going at the moment, maybe a better use of it.
Well, look, it's not going to disappear because it's going to go to governments. And we have pressing major revenue needs to invest in education, in healthcare, in the fight against climate change, in the energy transition, in public infrastructure. All of these things are going, like they have been historically, are going to be the key engine of future economic growth.
Gabriel Zucman there, Ayoka. I mean, it is an issue that we've seen discussed on a number of occasions, but how practical do you think it is for it to be implemented globally?
It's a tough proposal, I believe, from an implementation standpoint. And, you know, the 2% that would go to governments, I mean, we just talked about the issues of governments being able to handle their own finances. I think it's better off in the hands of the billionaires.
Yeah, just in terms, I suppose, of some people would say how they put that money into investments, etc. Of course, others would disagree and say that it is important for governments to have that so they can use it to spend on healthcare and their own populations. Now, deadly heat waves are becoming more intense and frequent in India, and the impact is being felt mostly by the country's poor. The blistering heat has affected the livelihoods of India's informal workforce, who make up half of the country's economy. Well, now an organization in India's western state of Gujarat is offering women laborers a heatwave insurance that pays for days when temperatures hit higher thresholds, giving them the freedom to avoid working during dangerously high temperatures. The BBC's Archana Shukla has this report.
With her bare hands, Hansa Nadia is sifting through piles of trash strewn along the roadside. Sweat dripping down. It's sweltering in Ahmedabad, but Hansa, a waste picker, is out working. At home, she empties her gun bag. Plastics, paper, metal cans. That's her collection after 6 hours run under the blazing sun. Last month, the heat stroke stole 6 days of work, leaving her weak, she tells me. Her monthly income halved to just $30. But there's respite. Hansa has an insurance for hot days.
I got $14 as insurance money. It helped me buy food for my family and medicines for myself. I could avoid working on days when it was too hot.
In the local market, roadside vendors are hoping to make a sale. It's hitting 44 degrees Celsius on the scale. Blistering heat is putting millions of poor Indians at risk. Most are part of the country's unorganized workforce, doing ad hoc jobs. Their choice, work in unsafe conditions or go hungry.
Women are among the worst affected, especially those on meager incomes like $60 to $70 a month. And for them, this heat insurance have actually come as a breather.
When mercury breaches a threshold, in Ahmedabad it is 44 degrees Celsius, those insured get an automatic payment of $4 a day. The payouts are small but critical even for those who work indoors. Sheikh Sabira is pasting colourful papers to make guides. She's sweating profusely but cannot use the fan, with loads of kite paper sheets lying around.
I get 3 cents per kite, but because of the heat, I can't sit for long. Have made just half the number of kites. The insurance money has helped.
Sabera continues work, attaching the string to the kites. 46,000 women like her have got paid for the hot days insurance. But with heat waves becoming more frequent and intense, meager payouts may not be enough. Anisha Mohammed Yunus works with the Self-Employed Women's Association, the Ahmedabad-based trade union that runs this novel heat insurance program. She says to scale it up, a policy push is needed.
Can heatwave insurance be included in the Social Security Act? Could the unspent welfare funds for construction workers and salt pan workers be redirected to climate support? We need to ask these questions, and both government and private sectors need to partner. We could be the first country to offer climate cover for informal workers.
Outside the metal fabrication shop, women are beating aluminium sheets to shape them into vessels. One of them tells me, heat or rain, they have to work to buy food. For these women and many others, it's a matter of survival. As extreme weather disrupts livelihoods, India's informal workforce, crucial for India's economy, needs a safety net more than ever before.
The BBC's Archana Shukla there reporting from Ahmedabad in the western Indian state of Gujarat, the state that the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi comes from. That is it for this edition of World Business Report.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle.
Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI for People.